In order to set the stage for the discussion of the National Bureau of Standards Western Automatic Computer, or SWAC, I would like to first of all indicate a little bit personal background, and I'll try to make this very brief in view of our instructions. In 1944, I was an instructor in mathematics at the University of Pennsylvania, and being interested in augmenting my income, I heard a rumor to the effect that you might be able to get a job at the Moore School. So I went around and applied, and not having any idea of what was going on inside that building. And after due process, I was let through the gate marked confidential, and I saw half of the ENIAC there. About half of the wrecks had been assembled, the rest of them were under construction. The design was complete, so I can claim that I did not contribute any invention whatsoever to the ENIAC. I did spend most of 1945 writing the technical description of the ENIAC, and if any of you have had occasion to read the ENIAC patent, lots of my words are present there. All the drawing numbers were changed, however. In 1946, I talked to Professor Hartree about what sort of opportunities there were in England, and by June of 1946, I decided to leave the Moore School. Really, the reason was interesting. Reed Warren asked me one day if I would like to be in charge of the project. Everybody was leaving, you see. So he asked me if I would like to be in charge of the project. Well, that sounded kind of interesting, this EDVAC project. But I was working for Professor Klein in the mathematics department, and when he heard about this, he hit the ceiling. Nobody was going to recruit his full-time people, you see, so that scotched that. So I decided to leave the Moore School anyway, and shortly after leaving, I received a cable from England saying, would I like to come to NPL? And I said, yes. I didn't know where NPL was, who was there or whatever, but I decided to come. In those days, it took considerable priority to get a passage across the North Atlantic, so I ended up not going until December and arrived in England the first week in January, and this was the worst winter that they've ever had, so I remember it very, very well. Well, it was an interesting year. We worked on the pilot model. I worked with Turing and so on. There are lots of stories there, but that's not the subject of today's lecture. So at the during the year there, I wrote to John Curtis that I'd heard was through the grapevine, was starting some kind of a computer activity at the Bureau of Standards. And more importantly, he was starting it in California. And after living in Philadelphia for a while, I had my eyes on California, you see. He offered me a job. I was supposed to report in Washington in January 48 for 6 weeks to find out how the government did its business. Then I'd go out to California and do what I was interested in doing. Well, I ended up spending the year in Washington. The Bureau was involved in contracting for a computer for the Census Bureau, and we were working with the Air Force, and we were trying to acquire a computer to set up at the Institute for Numerical Analysis in Los Angeles. And with this urge to get computers going and the troubles that the manufacturers were having in those days, we finally decided at the Bureau that we should build a computer. So we started out on an NBS interim computer. Now you're going to hear more about that one, so I won't say a word about it. No more about it, at least. Now we come down to October the 19th, 1948, in which the Applied Mathematics Executive Council met, and this was a group that John Curtis had to advise him in terms of the activities of the National Applied Mathematics Laboratories. And the question was up what to do about purchasing computers. For example, in March, the same group had decided that the Bureau should really buy 3 UNIVACs. One of these was to go to the Census Bureau, one was for the Air Materiel Command in Dayton, and the third one was to go to the Institute for Numerical Analysis in Los Angeles. But in between, there had been a security problem, and so it was decided that none of the military funds could be spent on any of these computers, so that opened up the whole question in October. The interesting thing in reading the minutes about the situation at that particular time is the sort of uncertainty that the people had who were making decisions about whether computers would work or not and so on. And I'd like to read from some of those minutes just a bit. I'll start out by reading about the Institute for Numerical Analysis, which had just completed a summer research program under the leadership of Professor Hartree from Cambridge. And the research was largely of a long-range nature and been performed by one of the most distinguished groups of research mathematicians ever gathered under civil service. Now, guess who wrote that? But anyway, it was an interesting activity, and the Institute was certainly a crossroads for the meeting of people who were interested in numerical computation. Skipping along a ways in the minutes here, it said the Machine Development Laboratory, which was one of the parts of the laboratories in Washington, had secured the services of Sam Lubkin, who was working with Division 13 in building the interim computer. I didn't say another word there, didn't I? A little later in the minutes, John Curtis reviewed the history of the machine program, and he talked about the initiation of the program to acquire a computer for the Census Bureau. And the earlier in the year, he had had a consulting job to, again, help the Bureau decide what it should do. This was led by Stibitz, with the help of both von Neumann and Aiken. And the gist of this report was that the Bureau shouldn't really mess around with building computers. They should work on improved components. Well, Curtis didn't really like that. In fact, I remember at a party that he held, and his parties were always remarkable. They were held in one-bedroom flats, and you invited three times as many people as could fit into that space, so it was a very interesting phenomenon. And in reporting the reception of this report from the consulting group, he came from the bathroom, and you could hear the sound of the plumbing fixtures in operation, and he announced, well, that disposed of that particular report. Now, in discussing what to do about computers, some of the people were asked to report on the status of computers at this particular time, and again, I'm reading from the minutes. Dr. Feldman of the Army Ordnance Department was asked for further information concerning the status of the EDVAC. He said the status appears to fluctuate, and apparently the contractors now need about $100,000 more to finish the machine, and it will take between 6 months and a year to test the machine and take the bugs out. He said the first model was definitely to go to Aberdeen and is not going to remain at the Moore School. Dr. Goldstein, upon inquiry concerning the Institute for Advanced Study Machine, stated that the use of a magnetic drum in the machine is still an open question. Work on the Selectron development RCA was still progressing satisfactorily, and he pointed out that up-to-date blueprints were not kept in connection with the development project because of the continuing circuit development. They expected the multiplier to be ready by January or February of 1949. Then there's a quite lengthy discussion of engineering research associates. The Bureau had had a contract with ERA to plan a magnetic drum computer. And the drum, by the way, had some 30 channels, it's 80 pulses to the inch and so on. It was eight sets of 30-bit parallel input-output, and the drum turned at 60 revolutions per second. So that's a measure of what the technology was like in those days. Now, skipping on down through the minutes that go on at great length to reporting the discussions of that particular day. The gist of the report is that the people on this advisory committee, who were representatives of the Air Force and the Office of Naval Research and so on, said that we should, that the Bureau shouldn't really build the same machine that somebody else was building. In particular, they should not build a copy of the Institute for Advanced Study machine. That it should be a diverse machine in some sense. And so finally there was a proposal to do a development of a Williams tube memory system at Los Angeles. This is really prior to the change at the Institute for Advanced Study in this particular direction, so the diversity was thought to be a correct characterization of that situation. It was to be financed out of the odds and ends of funds that were left over. And so that was the final decision then, and it was to be designed in such a way that if it didn't really work, then we could go back to magnetic drums. So that, of course, all of us young people, we had no doubts, you know, we could build this equipment, it would work, and wouldn't take very long to do it, which has been reported on in other places. So in any case, in December of 1948, I moved out to Los Angeles, and I was given an empty room, half the size of this one or a little less, and said, go ahead. So I found some people around Los Angeles that were interested in risking their career in this kind of activity, and we bought some equipment. In particular, we had just terminated a study contract with Eckert and Mockley, so we asked for all the machine tools and so on to be shipped to Los Angeles and caused some trouble for them. But we put together a group, and under Mr. Ambrosio, with the help of Mr. Larson, who's here someplace, we worked on Williams tube memory operating in a parallel mode. Ed Lacey worked in an arithmetic unit, and here we made fairly good use of the kind of circuitry that was developed at Whirlwind. The control unit was worked on by Dave Rutland, and we proceeded to try to put together a computer. The name of this first, this particular computer for a long time was Zephyr, and motivated for the same reasons that we've heard about in the May Breeze story. Of course, there was a lot of competition in those days, and I've had it reported to me that there are other groups that said that the proper name was Socorro, which meant a hot wind from the desert. Well, we proceeded to try out various kinds of cathode ray tubes, and we became fond of one that had the deflection electrodes on the neck. This was somewhat less capacity, and that allowed you to drive the get response out of the deflection circuit somewhat more easily. So we designed some circuitry and got to the point where this would work reasonably well. And turned out that each particular tube had three or four spots on it that would not store information. This turned out to be little carbonized particles of lint, so that if you tried to charge one end, it got conducted all along here, and it didn't really work very well. Well, then the question came up, if the average tube has three or four spots, and you build 37 of these, deflecting all of these in synchronism, and you have, we started out hoping for 1,024 bits, and we trimmed that down to 512, and finally, well, let's start at 256. Can you deflect all these 256 bits around in unison on these 37 tubes so that no one of them lands upon one of these carbonized spots? And in contrast to proper engineering design that's been commented upon here before, where you have 2-to-1 safety factors, how do you know that you're not bombarding right alongside that carbonized spot and any slight drift will bring you over on it? Well, we didn't know. So anyway, we spent a lot of effort in producing extremely stable power supplies so we could control drift and have some reasonable period of operating time without trouble about such spots. At about this late date in the game, we discovered that Dumont, that was making these cathode ray tubes, had taken over an old mattress factory, and that probably contributed to the density of lint. Well, we put this computer together, and it was dedicated in 1950, and then we proceeded to improve upon it. We were given a motor generator set from UCLA, and for some reason it had the wrong number of pole pieces. So that meant that every once in a while one of your cycles was a little bigger than the others, and that came right through the power supply filters and caused us trouble. So we ultimately ended up by going to Westinghouse and buying a brand new, beautiful motor generator set so we'd have a stable power supply. Other improvements, we'd always planned to attach a magnetic drum to this, and we bought a magnetic drum from Professor Paul Morton at Berkeley. And this was the early days in manufacturing magnetic drums, so this was made from extruded aluminum tubing, for example. And it turns out that things like aluminum may have stress in the material when it's made. And as time goes on, this relaxes and flows a little bit. And although the drum was perfectly round when it was delivered to us within very reasonable tolerances, we were a little slow getting around to building the circuitry that worked with it. And by the time it was really ready to use, we discovered it was no longer round. Well, we could return it and so on. But this was one of the kinds of problems. And meanwhile, there was a lot of folklore that it was a good idea to haul such drums around in the trunk of your car for 6 months so we'd get a lot of exercise. And nobody really knew what it took to make a good magnetic drum, or if they did, they weren't telling us about it. Ultimately, we actually purchased a drum from another company, and it was attached to the machine, and it was put into satisfactory operation. We never did push the high-speed memory above the 256 bits for exactly these reasons about the flaws and so on. Williams tubes have another difficulty in that when you access a particular point, this stirs up secondary electrons, and these tend to discharge all the nearby information that you have. So you have something called a read-around ratio, which is how many times I can look at that spot before I ruin the neighbors. Now, we always knew this was going to happen, so there was a systematic regeneration of the whole pattern in, say, odd memory cycles, and in even memory cycles, we would access numbers and do our arithmetic and so on. So so because of read-around ratio, this limited what you could do. You could you were between the devil and the deep blue sea, as we say, because if you if you moved your parameters in one direction, you'd make the flaws less troublesome, but your read-around ratio would collapse. If you tried to improve read-around ratio with sharper focus and so on, then the flaws were more of a decisive problem. So it was kind of a difficult situation there. Now, I think another interesting point is we worked on some diagnostic procedures. One of the problems is we had designed this machine and we were in a hurry and so on, so we didn't really think through adequate diagnostic techniques. The whole question is, well, try to get together something that would work and so forth, and we had limited budgets in those days. This odds and ends of the budget that was left over at the Bureau, so to speak. So therefore, we were in the situation of after the fact, hoping to create reasonable diagnostic capability. Well, as I mentioned, we used the brute force technique and the arithmetic unit, following World 1-1 kind of techniques, and using high-powered tubes. We used a 6AG7 that passed about 40 milliamps when it's on. And if you line these up in a 37-bit arithmetic unit where all the signals were driven by cathode followers, so you didn't have symmetric loads, then the difference in current when you have the register all filled with ones and when it's all filled with zeros comes up maybe 10 amps, you see. Well, this didn't turn out to be so bad. What we discovered is if you multiplied ones by ones for a tenth of a second, and in the next tenth of a second, you went off and did your diagnostic program, then you could manage to get excursions in the power supply of 20 volts or so, you see. So this gave you a nice technique for varying the DC voltage supply to this unit. And if the machine succeeded in passing your diagnostic routines under these situations, we never did discover a practical problem where it had any difficulty. So that turned out to be a very satisfactory after-the-fact kind of diagnostic technique. In 1954, the Institute for Numerical Analysis was destroyed. I think that word was used here earlier. The remains were transferred to the mathematics department at UCLA as a numerical analysis project. And as a result of all that, the SWAC was moved over to the engineering building and put back into operation. Well, we're running short on time, so I'll just say that At the old age of 17, the SWAC retired from service. That was in December of 1967. Thank you.
Any questions? John Bilhart, Arizona. Could you say a few words about the demise of that organization? I mean, what caused it?
It's a fairly complicated story. And I was sort of on the peripheral of the central action, so I will tell you my understanding of what it is. The initial trouble, as far as I know, was the trouble with battery acid. The Bureau, there was an additive that you could add to batteries that would make them last longer, said the manufacturer. The Bureau proceeded to test this and alleged that it wasn't so, and then there was a great fuss. Now, perhaps stemming from that, there was the review of what the Bureau was doing and the general feeling that it was expanding into areas that it shouldn't. During this period, for example, it had set up the laboratories at Corona, and there was a lot of activity going on to the Bureau that was not really directly associated with standards, at least in the minds of the people in Congress. So as a result of all this kind of review operation, it was decided to cut back on the activities, and in particular, the Institute at Los Angeles was one of the activities that was axed in this situation. There are perhaps other people here who know better than I exactly what happened.